Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Addition Financial, offering their Savings Plus account with a 4% annual percentage yield. Serving Central Floridians since 1937 and was recently named one of Newsweek's best regional credit unions. More at additionfi.com/NPR. Applicable on savings up to $5,000. Rate subject to change, federally insured by NCUA.
Growing plants and human tissue in space. You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Marion Summerall, filling in for Brendan Byrne. On Earth, plant life is abundant. In space, not so much. But NASA scientists are trying to change that. Experiments on orbit are exploring how the effects of space affect plant life and how moon or Mars-bound astronauts might grow their own food. We'll speak with NASA's Lisa Carnell about those efforts. Then, the aerospace manufacturer and space infrastructure technology company Redwire Space is working with scientists to 3D print human cells, tissues, and even organs on orbit. The goal is to help with new biomedical experiments. We'll speak with Redwire's Ken Savin about these medical breakthroughs in space. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? Fresh vegetables, herbs, and fruit provide a lot of vitamins and nutrients for the human body. NASA scientists are working to bring the benefits of fresh produce to astronauts by growing fresh food on the International Space Station. Here to talk about how plants can grow in an environment without sunlight or gravity, how the research can help terrestrial agriculture, and a lost tomato in space is Lisa Carnell, the Division Director of the Biological and Physical Sciences at NASA. Lisa, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's really exciting to be here. Let's talk about some of the equipment necessary for plants to grow in space. I mean, here on Earth, you can, you know, with different vegetables, you can just water it and plant it in the ground outside. But I'm sure there's a lot more technology that's involved when growing it in an environment that doesn't have sunlight or Earth's gravity, right?
Right. So, that is such a key point, especially when we're thinking microgravity. I'm sure you've seen a lot of those images of the astronauts with water bubbles floating around and they're grabbing them, you know, like kind of with their mouths. Well, everything floats, right? And so how do we get, even, you know, if you have a dish or you have a container with water in it, how do you get that to actually move and flow up the plant? Because it doesn't, you don't have that same gravity assist that you normally have on the ground. And so we've worked really hard to develop technology that actually facilitates that entire process so that we can water the plants appropriately or develop technologies where we can do minimal water needed. So that's been some of the big areas of thrust for NASA in developing technology for plants in space.
So with watering the plants, can we kind of talk about that a little bit more? Like, is there a tube?
Yeah. So actually there are, you know, it's when we think about watering here on the ground, you know, you go out, you water your lawn, you might spray the hose and it's going to, you know, seep into the lawn. Well, it doesn't work the same in space. So right now they have tubes that will actually, there are some, there's, believe it or not, we have multiple different types of technologies that we use for plant watering and crop growth because we're trying to see which one works the best, right? And also so that we can increase our crop yield. So we do have some that have those tubes that you were just talking about where we actually will inject the water into the tube and it's positioned in the right place so that they get the water. We actually have technology, believe it or not, they're called like little pillows that are fitted around the roots of the plants that are, you know, full of that water and whatever the components are, media, fertilizer that's needed for those roots to thrive. So we have all sorts of unique capabilities just to water the plants.
Wow, that is fascinating. And I'm sure it's the same, you know, too, with, you got to make sure the soil doesn't fly away as well, you know?
Exactly.
I know that there's a couple different ways to take care of the plants. So kind of walk me through both how the astronauts that are up there can take care of them and get those samples back to Earth, but also are any of them self-sufficient? You know, all the astronaut has to do is just take the sample and bring it back down to Earth.
Yeah. And actually, that is one of the things that we're striving for, is to make these much more autonomous, right? So that they can be almost self-sustaining, self-watering, you know, so that right now we do have some capabilities where, you know, we just have the astronauts come by and maybe put some water in periodically. But aside from that, they monitor and take care of themselves in all the other ways. We have specialized lighting systems that provide that additional, like, different types of wavelengths. Different types of wavelengths help grow plants better in different environments and different types of plant species. But as far as the astronaut, you know, they actually go in and, you know, create that yield for us, bag it up, and bring it on home. So you probably heard too about that lost tomato in space.
Yeah, and I was going to ask if we want to talk about the lost tomato.
Oh my goodness. And then that was one of the experiments that we did in our division, you know, and everybody kept saying, they ate it. We know somebody ate it. Well, they actually discovered it recently, and it had been lost for, I want to say, at least a good year or so. They found it. The lost tomato. So it made the news. NASA is very protective of the astronauts, and we have a lot of safety requirements around eating the vegetables or anything that's grown up there. In fact, they are required to use a type of chemical to clean the vegetables beforehand. A very rigorous protocol. And so the thought that, and nobody's allowed to eat it without permission. And so the thought that somebody, it really turned into this big policing experience where, you know, where did the tomato go? Somebody ate it without permission. Well, it was actually very comical. So when he actually, you know, Frank Rubio, I believe, like, said, I found it, you know, it's a big deal. We did eat it. Okay, that's what.
Kind of going on that track, you know, what are some of the big changes we have seen in plants that are, you know, grown in space? Are the tomatoes that are up there giant tomatoes? Are they doing better up there or the same? Let's kind of jump into that as well.
I can say that I would not say that anything is doing better per se. We do have several different types of lettuce and crops that are thriving just as well as they would on Earth. Right. So I think that to me is an testament of how far we've come in doing crop growth in space. I think that, you know, when it comes to one thing we're really focusing a lot on is less about the size of the different types of crops, but the nutrient density of the crops. So like micronutrients, or can we, you know, we started looking at, you know, CRISPR modified organisms, you know, where we go in and do some gene editing and try to bring in more nutrients into that tiny small tomato or the lettuce that's being grown. So those are some of the new cutting edge areas that we've been really working closely to try to maximize that intake and what we get out of every crop that's grown.
And I'm sure it's really important that those plants are packed with nutrients, because in space, a lot of the astronauts, they can't have deficiencies in certain areas, like making sure they're getting their vitamins and their nutrients. So is that kind of why they're a little bit smaller, but packed with those nutrients? So eventually one day, when we are going on these longer journeys, it'll be better for the human body up there as well.
Absolutely. You know, so when we're thinking about, even if it's, you're thinking sustainable presence on the lunar surface or a trip to Mars, you know, at that time, we need to be able to grow crops that are going to fulfill those nutrients that we can't take, you know, a plethora of vitamins with us on a daily basis, because that's just the volume, mass of carrying all of that is really a bit much. So, you know, the other part that it is, you know, the psychological benefits of cultivating your own crops. What does that do for the crew member who, you know, we at home, we grow plants, we grow crops, and, you know, because we enjoy it, we do it for sustainability, but we also do it because we, you know, as a hobby, if you will. And so we've done some psychological evaluations to see how this impacts the crew members and what is that psychological benefit to actually growing, you know, your own tomato or growing your own flower? And so those are some of the really, you know, big takeaways that are those intangible benefits that you get that you don't realize. It's not just about the nutrients.
And I bet it's comforting for them to be able to kind of see something that might be in their own home when they're in their own kitchen and they're making a salad or some food, or in their backyard. Have any astronauts said it's nice to see a little bit of green in the vastness of space?
Absolutely. You hit the nail on the head with that one. We get a lot of feedback like that, that, you know, the crew members love to, you know, the freshness of, you know, the crops. In fact, I can't tell you how many have said it's one of their favorite parts of their day is going to visit the crops or to water them, you know, that they really enjoy tending them and taking care of the plants.
Wow. And are there any plants or future projects that we can look forward to and be able to see being grown in space with the new year? It's 2024 now. Anything exciting happening soon?
For now, we have grown so many different varieties of plants in the space environment. We've grown herbs. We have grown chili peppers. NASA has grown lettuce. If you remember, the crew actually... that was one of the very first crops that was grown and actually eaten by the crew members. So that was really exciting for NASA, you know, especially as we start to look at long duration transit and space exploration. How can we feed the crew? But we have grown Arabidopsis plants, so many different types, Mizuno lettuce, you name it. We've been experimenting with it and trying it. There is always something growing up there in the multiple different types of hardware systems that we have, where we're maybe testing that hardware on a particular crop or testing out brand new crops. But one thing that I find really exciting, especially going into the new year, is how we can start exploring how we grow these crops in another planetary body, so on another planetary surface. So you might have seen last year where Annalisa Paul and Rob Furl were able to grow crops. They put seedlings in lunar regolith from three different regions that, you know, were collected from Apollo era. And they found in two of the regions, it actually grew better than the third. So what that tells us is that this may help us really locate where the best sustainable presence is. Really looking forward to seeing more of that type of research done. And can we bring some of that regolith up to the space station environment and start trying to grow it, combine those two aspects? That's what I'd like to see in the future.
Lisa Carnell is the Division Director of the Biological and Physical Sciences Division at NASA. Lisa, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's been a fun, and it's great to be able to share all the excitement around growing plants in space.
Still to come, 3D printed cardiac tissue in space. That's ahead on Are We There Yet?
Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Addition Financial, offering their Savings Plus account with a 4% annual percentage yield. Serving Central Floridians since 1937 and was recently named one of Newsweek's best regional credit unions. More at additionfi.com/NPR. Applicable on savings up to $5,000. Rate subject to change, federally insured by NCUA.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Marion Summerall, filling in for Brendan Byrne.
3D printers have been used to help with biological human studies, making things like organs or muscle tissue. But now the aerospace manufacturer and space infrastructure technology company, Redwire, is bringing 3D printing to space. The company has successfully printed human cells and tissue, like knee cartilage. Now, the company is attempting to print cardiac tissue on orbit. Here to talk about how scientists are crafting human cells in space and what makes this possible is Redwire Chief Scientist Ken Savin. Ken, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, Ken, for our folks who may be listening who may not know what Redwire is, could you give us a little background on the company and some of the work that you and your team do?
So Redwire is an aerospace company, and we do a lot of different things. The way our company has kind of been formed, we are operated as a lot of several, I think it's now eight, separate entities, small companies that are coming together and work with each other to deliver solutions to people that want to do things in space. So we do everything from manufacturing a large solar arrays, like the new solar panels are being installed on the space station. We built those. We built navigation systems for satellites. And there was just a couple of years ago, the effort to knock an asteroid off course. That was ours, the DART mission. We built the navigation systems for that. We build high-fidelity cameras for use on space systems. If you see pictures from the Artemis mission to go around the moon, those pictures are most likely from our cameras. So those are some of the things we do. And these are just in describing that, you understand some of the activities that, of course, are happening right now as part of the space mission in the United States and in Europe. And at the same time, the part of the company I work with, which is, you know, has a 35-year history of doing interesting work, is really focused on helping people do science in space. Okay, so people who want to run experiments in space, you can't just do it. I as a private citizen, I used to think, like, how would you even do that? How would you even get an experiment launched into space? And we do that. We help scientists understand how to get into the NASA system, how to get your experiment manifested on a rocket, launched into space, and then operated by an astronaut on some space platform, probably the International Space Station, and then return to you. And along the way, we also build all the hardware that enables that experiment to be run. So a lot of things that we would think, like I as a scientist would go into a lab and try to execute some experiment, you can't do that when you're in space for a lot of reasons, safety reasons, but also because of the unique environment.
You mentioned some of the technology that Redwire has made. Can we talk a little bit about this 3D printer that has been used to make different cells and skin tissue? Can we talk about that?
So just so as for a little background for everybody, Redwire has a long history of building additive manufacturing systems for use in space. Now, some of these are for exploration, like if you're on the moon or you're going to Mars and you need a part, you can't just go online, go to Amazon and try to order it, right? It's not going to get there in time. You can't do that. So what you can do, though, is you can have the plans for some part or device or what have you sent to you right at the speed of light. And then if you have an additive manufacturing machine on your spaceship or on your space station, you can make it. So, over the years now have generated several different types of devices, some that print in plastic, some that print in ceramic, some that print a kind of resin, some that print in metal. We have a printer that prints titanium parts. With that, the topic that you really want us to get to is the fact that we also have a printer that prints tissue. Printing tissue, I think someday will have real impact on, people going out into space as a kind of therapy or what have you. But the printer we have developed is really done in a way that will be used for printing tissue for people on Earth. It's for human benefit here on Earth. We've printed a couple of different types of tissue. For the most part, we're doing things that are associated with a principal investigator who is on the ground, like somebody working at a university or what have you. And they come to us and say, this is what we want to try to print. This is, the parameters, the requirements, and the type of cells. And then we get all the material together, we launch it in a rocket, and we print that in space and bring it back down for study.
What is it like to work on a printer that is being used to print these human skin cells and tissues in space?
Oh, it's great. I'll tell you, when I first heard they were doing it, I'm a scientist from a major industry. And I heard the first time I heard them saying they were going to, this is what we're working on. And I was like, no way that's, but it is, it's really a remarkable thing to see and to be a part of and to watch it kind of unfold from the beginning. We're at a very early stage in this, right? Printing tissue is done. People have printed different types of tissues on the ground, and there's devices that do that. But what we're doing is different in that by using the microgravity environment of space, so things don't weigh the same. They don't weigh anything. You're nothing. It allows you to stack things up without them collapsing. You can essentially pile things that are only slightly more viscous than water, and they won't puddle out and fall to the, they'll just hold their position. And with just a couple of weeks of them being put into a special type of incubator, which will allow it to ferment, to gel up, you can then bring it down and it holds its shape. And technology, stem cell technology, printing technology, materials technology is all coming together to do these fantastic things. It's really, I think it's still every, I go to meetings and we're talking about things and it's almost like science fiction. But we're doing it.
It really does sound like science fiction. What are some of the other projects that Redwire has worked on or plans to work on with skin and organs with a 3D printer?
The meniscus print was actually, it was launched in probably November of 2022. And this was for Uniformed Services University, part of a kind of a military a university that's very interested in these types of things. It turns out that a torn meniscus is like one of the, if not the leading orthopedic injuries, right? For people in the military, maybe for everybody. And there isn't a good, there are treatments, but they aren't really satisfactory ultimately, right? You can't replace it at this point. You just let it sort of heal itself over. And it's a scar tissue that is not nearly as good as meniscal tissue. So the ability to make one, to print one and use that for a repair has potentially significant advantage. Not okay, so from the standpoint of the number of times it could be done, but also the impact on people's lives. So the material was put up into space, it is printed, and then allowed, as I mentioned, to gel and brought back down, and it's brought to the principal investigator for further study. And we're really in the beginnings of this, but ultimately, this will step towards being used for study, for them just taking it and understanding it, to then being used as a model for for disease states, how can we better understand the meniscus by making our own and using that for study and potentially for treatment? Then we'll step into actually using it as a tissue replacement therapy. I mean, that's what we're ultimately trying to get to. And the meniscus was a fantastic choice for a couple of reasons. We've talked about its utility, but also as a tissue itself, it is one that has to have certain properties to be really useful, and we have to be able to reproduce those useful properties. So it was a good target in that way. It is a lot of matrix. There's more matrix than there are cells, which makes it a unique tissue, but one that we do have to kind of understand. There's a whole spectrum, right? Some tissues are all cells, very little matrix. For us, I think it was a good start. The next tissue, one that we're working on currently, we actually launched it in October of last year, and we've done a couple of prints, is cardiac tissue. So we're starting to look at the heart. And again, it will probably go through the same set of steps. First, it will be used just to understand our ability to print it. Then it will be used as a model so that, let's say, a pharmaceutical company can use it as a consistent model for testing potential therapies, drug therapies. And then we'll get to the point where we can actually make a heart patch, a small piece of tissue that has been vascularized and can be put into, let's say, part of the heart where somebody's had a heart attack and part of the cardiac tissue is gone, is dead. You could replace that. And then ultimately what we would, you know, we all talk about is someday printing up hearts, right? And the beauty is that we can print with tissue from the person who's going to receive that heart. It will be genetically identical, right? Because you don't have to use embryonic or cord cells. You can use like mesenchymal stem cells, which are coming from the person who is going to be the ultimate recipient. And just through the modern technology of stem cell, where you can essentially reprogram those cells into stem cells, you know, regular cells out of a person. I think it's just, it is the future. It is where we're headed. And then it alleviates other problems that we have. The fact that there aren't enough donors, and most likely there aren't enough donors that are good matches for those people. So that's what we're trying to get to. And it is an interesting thing to be at the beginning of it, to see it and see the discussions and hear what people are talking about and understand the potential that we have for benefit to humanity.
It's fascinating to think that we may be able to create an entire organ from 3D printing. And this movement in space exploration to have people living in space and on different planets, how will this technology aid that goal?
Well, I think there's a couple of parts to that. So first of all, technology like this will help humanity, whether they're on the Earth or in space, right? So there are benefits in that way. And I think that the things that we do, that we learn in this way, have implications to humanity just in general. I think at the same time, by pushing ourselves, doing the things that we're doing here and pushing to do things in space, which is a very difficult endeavor, you really do force yourself to think differently and to come up with solutions that will have other applications. Just thinking about going back to like the Apollo days and space shuttle, which seem in some ways like ancient history, but there are breakthroughs that had to be made to enable those efforts that we benefit from every day, right? There's memory foam mattresses and Mylar, super insulating materials. The first laptop computer was made for a space shuttle mission. You just go on. And then the other things about striving to get out into space and our ability to occupy it, you just look at day-to-day things like GPS. My kids will never know the happy feelings of going to their computer and printing out a map so that they can figure out where they are going, you know, getting the trip decks from AAA. They'll never know that because their car, they're just going to say, I'm going here, and the car is going to put a map in and take them there. And I think the impact of things like GPS are only at the beginning. I think there'll be a point in time where we won't drive our cars. The cars will be driven for us. And a lot of that will be based on a global positioning system, which is, you know, the result of our ability to have access to space.
Ken, this was great. I cannot wait to hear more about what Redwire is doing. And thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Mary.
That was Redwire Chief Scientist Ken Savin. That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to this show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Subscribe on NPR One, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We've got more space coverage online. Visit WMFE.org/space. Are We There Yet is a production of 90.7 WMFE News. Our host is Brennan Byrne. Our producer is me, Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Marion Summerall. Thanks for listening.